Hi, I'm Mark Chavez. I'm one of the hosts of Let's Make A, a comedy docuseries podcast about the creative process. Each season, my co-hosts, Ryan Beal, Maddie Kelly, and I take on an artistic challenge and you follow our journey. In Let's Make A Sci-Fi, we wrote a science fiction TV pilot. In Let's Make A Rom-Com, we wrote a romantic comedy film. And on our latest season, Let's Make A Horror, we produced a horror short film. And when we run into trouble, we interview Hollywood experts. People who have worked on big things like The Blair Witch Project, The Office, Star Wars, Mamma Mia, and more. All three seasons of Let's Make A are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Listen, I know that every week we say that so much has happened in pop culture, but this week, truly, there is so much going on. There is a Fallout adaptation. There is Ripley on Netflix. There's O.J. Simpson to talk about, J. Cole and Kendrick. The group chat is here. Let's not waste time. Let's go. I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Okay, let's not actually waste any time. Let's just bring in the group chat. Nico Stratus is here. Rad Simon Pelay is here. Pablo the Don is back. Pablo, Nico, Rad, welcome to the show, everybody. How are we feeling? Hello.
Hey.
What up?
Hi.
Good.
Hi.
Look, there's a lot to get into. There's a lot to get into today, but before we dive too far, I just want to start with O.J. Simpson. I think that's important to start with. We heard yesterday that O.J. died. He was 76 years old. OJ was a massive NFL star, one of the biggest athletes turned celebrities that I can think of. Of course, he's probably known best, I think, for the double murder trial, right? He was charged and acquitted for the murder of his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman. The police chase was a TV moment. The trial was like a defining event of the 90s. There's been countless adaptations of the OJ story. In many ways, I think like our entertainment ecosystem was deeply shaped by just how we talk about OJ. Like, I genuinely think you can write a PhD on just how OJ has changed entertainment. We're going to spend more time on this conversation next week, but maybe we'll go around the table briefly here. Rad, maybe briefly, what was your reaction when you heard the news of OJ's death?
I mean, I guess confusion, right? Like, how do you how are you supposed to feel about this? Because in the same way that there's a discussion about how do you talk about OJ, it's like, well, how do you feel after he passed? Because even before all of that stuff that you mentioned, like, this guy was a significant pop cultural icon. I mean, you think about, like, you know, beyond football, you think about the orange juice commercials, the Hertz commercials. You think about his, you know, what made him so appealing to white people, like in this affable, maybe even servile quality, you know, and how that like kind of lent to his space, having space in the movies, like the Naked Gun franchise, where, you know, he kind of occupied a space similar to The Rock, where he's like this athlete who's so likable and he can't necessarily act, but he could do it well enough that he could have some self-deprecating fun.
Yeah.
And then came the trial, the car chase, the trial, and all of that stuff that totally eclipsed whatever significance he had before that.
I think if you enter the story of OJ at the moment of the trial, then you're sort of like, you're missing all this context that came before, just like how massive a star OJ was then. Nico, I'm just a tiny little baby. I'm so young. I did not watch the OJ chase on television, but you might have done so. What comes to mind when you think of like how that trial was covered?
Yeah, as the representative of the only openly person in my 40s member of the community group chat.
Oh my god,
Brad's there with me.
I was watching too. Sorry. Yeah,
it was a big deal. I mean, it was everywhere, right? Yeah. It was on the radio. Like, I mean, I was living in the Yukon. I was living in the middle of nowhere, and it was a big news story there. You know, like between OJ and Diana, it was like a big decade for car chases that it didn't end all that well.
Yeah.
You know, but it was like it was a thing that was like, you know, it was on TV. It's on the radio. Teachers were talking about it at school. It was this sort of omnipresent thing that you watched slowly unfold. You know, you would see it on covers of magazines, and you would, you know, the way we used to follow news stories back when news stories used to sort of droll out over a longer period of time, it really felt like it defined a period of time. And then afterwards, everything sort of felt different. Like, it was this pivotal moment for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just add about like who was watching it? Like, my grandma, I was a kid when was happening.
Yeah.
My grandma, refugee grandma who didn't speak a word of English, was glued to the trial. So that's how big it was.
Well, I'll tell you who does not remember it is Pablo the Don, because Pablo, you weren't even born when this whole thing was happening. How have you interacted with the OJ story?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think I was a thought when OJ did the trial and everything. I don't think my parents had thought of conceiving me yet.
Yes.
But my first interaction with OJ is in 2008 when the memorabilia story comes out. And me being, I think I'm 12 or 13 at the time, I'm like, oh, he's just going to get his stuff back. Like,
you're talking about the case against him for armed robbery because he tried to, I mean, he was convicted of
he
robbing
a place.
He went
to go get his stuff back.
Yeah, he went to, continue, sorry.
But my experiences are colored by my family and those news stories that come out, which newsflash, if you guys didn't notice, my family's Black. So a lot of them, actually, when the trial happened and everything and he gets acquitted, were like, well, maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. But this might be a win because this is the first Black man we've ever seen get off of this sort of magnitude of a case. So that's kind of how my lens is colored going into this. And then OJ Made in America comes out about 10 years after, almost 10 years after the sports memorabilia case. And then I really get to see who OJ was before the trial, before all those things. And that's where I'm like, oh, this is a lot more complicated than anything. And then Jay-Z hits us with the story of OJ. And then I'm like, oh, this is even more layered and complicated than I ever thought.
Exactly right. We're going to dig into all of these complications next week because I think there's so much to talk about when it comes to how OJ informed popular culture. We're going to switch gears for now because honestly, it's been a really big week for fans of the video game Fallout because Amazon has just released their TV adaptation of this game. Fallout is an incredibly popular game. A lot of people were waiting for this moment. They're waiting for this incredible story to be sort of translated to the screen. We should tell people, like, the series is set in this nuclear aftermath of the post-apocalyptic Earth. Most people, you know, nicknamed Vault Dwellers, they've lived, you know, over 200 years underground in these Fallout bunkers. And then we meet Ella. And Ella is going to go exploring all the whole brutal wastelands of what used to be Los Angeles. Take a listen to this.
The mission of the vaults should be important to everyone.
Can you tell me what's happened in the last 200 years?
Holy shit. You're an actual vault dweller.
I am.
I thought all you dipshits were dead.
Fallout just started streaming this week. Nico, Rad, Pablo, let's get into this. Nico, I'm going to start with you. You've been chomping at the bit to talk about this series. How are you feeling about it after watching the first episode?
I feel great. It's one of those things where it's like, here's the thing that I like. Like, I played, to go back to the fact that I'm old, you know, I remember I played Fallout 2 in 1997 when I was a teenager, and I was like, this is my favorite thing. I love this.
I was
on
nine,
board.
But cool.
Fan
love
ever
that for
since.
You. Yep.
I mean, sure. Yeah. Let's. We used to rent a VCR when I was a kid if we really want to dial it back, you know?
Got it.
But it's this thing where it's like, you know, so often adaptations are so difficult, right? We've seen this in so many different mediums where, like, it can go south really easily. And when they were like, we're going to do a Fallout TV show, my initial instinct was, no, we're not. Like, what if we just leave well enough alone? What if we walk away? What if we do something else?
Yeah.
So I was going in very cautiously, but I really wanted to, like, to see this world sort of brought into, like, a place where they could tell a story in it. And watching it, I watched a couple episodes last night and I walked away just being like, this is it. They did it. They nailed it. Yeah. Out of the park, guys. Great job.
What a satisfying feeling that is when you see something that you love and then you go, okay, what a relief that they actually did it faithfully. Pablo, you're a huge fan of Fallout. Also, how faithful to the game is this series? Does it need to be faithful? How are you feeling?
No, it doesn't need to be faithful. Fallout is a multi-layered, multi-universe. I mean, I'm coming into the game on Fallout 3. That's when my thumbs finally work to wrap around a controller to play it.
Yeah.
So I think that the show takes on its own life form and it tells a completely different story that's just set in the universe of Fallout, which I enjoy because there's nothing to compare it to really other than is the universe there? Is the universe that they're putting this in somewhat intact? Is there ghouls? Is there these core elements to the game? And yes, so far, yes, they've done these things. So I think they've done a great job of trying to create their own narrative within the universe instead of trying to pick one of the stories from the actual games and follow that narrative.
Nico, to that point, though, if you loved playing Fallout, you're going to want to see some of the elements that you loved in the game of Fallout in a TV show. So how precious do we actually need to be about the elements of gameplay and the elements of game story making into a TV adaptation?
I mean, not at all. This is the thing, you know, this the failing of The Last of Us adaptation, for instance, was that it took the plot of the game and it transposed it to TV. So if you've played the game, you know where that story is going. Mm. The thing that Fallout does really well, you know, it is this beautiful world. It's this retro-futuristic world that has a lot of elements in it. And what it does instead is it gives you the universe and it says, we're going to tell an entirely different story set within the confines of this universe that you know and understand, which is such a perfect thing because you can kind of have that element of surprise and wonder, and you can pick out things. If you're a fan, you can be like, oh, that's this or that's that. And you have those moments. But if you don't have those things, you're still invited in. And like, we don't need to be faithful to these things. Just tell the story within this. Give yourselves room to tell a story. Let Walton Goggins play Bizarro Raylan Givens in this thing. Like, let's go nuts. Like, it's perfect.
First of all, I wasn't aware that there are criticisms to be made of The Last of Us, because as far as I can tell, that series is perfect. So I'm just going to take your comment and park it in a different side of my brain that I'm going to return to for a while. Because, Rad, honestly, to me, like, the success of shows like The Last of Us, but also The Witcher and Halo, has proven there is this appetite, right, for these, like, for these video game adaptations to make it to the small screen. Do you feel like Fallout falls in the same kind of league as these other adaptations?
Well, first of all, I should say I'm on Nico's side when it comes to Last of Us. Okay. I'll just leave the show.
You guys can just have it to yourselves.
Two against one.
I feel like there has, like, you know, on the one hand, yes, video game adaptations are better than they've ever been. On the other hand, like, you guys are so happy that it's not like the 93 Mortal Kombat movie. That, like, well, you're so relieved. which I love for very, you know, just for that song.
Pablo throwing their hands up in the air, being like, whoa.
Yeah. All right, Street Fighter movie then. Let's stick with the Street Fighter movie. Remember Van Damme? Yes. But yeah, we've come a long way since then to the point that I feel like then there's this, like, all of a sudden, oh my God, The Last of Us is a masterpiece, and maybe even Fallout 2. Like, whereas, no, they're good. They're nifty. It's cool. Fallout's cool. It's got this nifty 50s retro post-apocalyptic popularity thing. But I do think that video game writing has come so far and along where, like, you know, the narratives you see in video games are almost worthy of television and film feature writing. Like, they have qualified writers on these shows that they become easily adaptable, to the point where if you didn't deliver on a video game adaptation, like, that would be embarrassing because they're giving you the goods. You know what I mean?
So. Okay, that's fair. I can sort of buy that. I still think that you guys are out to lunch on The Last of Us because, honestly, like, I'm someone who did not play The Last of Us and I had such an incredible time. But also, I can think of plenty of critics who are like, I love the video game so much that I was upset that they're even attempting to touch it, and then it was still a perfect delivery. But apparently, we got two people in this room who are like, The Last of Us, I don't know about this. Okay, we're fine.
Oh wow.
Okay, you know what I'm gonna do? This is the trick that radio people do, is go, I'm gonna move on now. All right, thank you. I'm gonna move on. I'm gonna move on to our next topic. Commotion will be back in a second.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight. Like, why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
All right, we're back. My name is Alamin Abdul Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Let's listen to one of the most talked about diss tracks in rap music right now.
Your first was classic, your last was tragic, your second put sleep but they gassed it, your third was massive and that was your prime. I was trailing right behind and I just now hit mine. Now I'm front of the line with a comfortable lead. High running, soon as I got it, now he wants something with me. Well, he caught me at the perfect time. Jump up and see where I got here off of.
That is 7 minute drill. It is off J. Cole's latest mixtape, Might Delete Later. This is a diss track that you're listening to right now. It is a diss track directed at Kendrick Lamar. It is in response to Kendrick's own diss track, which was aimed at Drake and also J. Cole. Drake himself has yet to release any music responding to either Kendrick or Cole at this point. But this entire sort of, like, fighting has been a lot of fun because it's been driving a lot of the, you know, the online rap debates at the moment. Pablo, can you explain how we got to this moment where J. Cole does a diss track aimed directly at Kendrick and then And then J. Cole goes, I'm sorry. I apologize. In fact, I will take it back. What happened here?
I mean, well, we got to take it back to 2013 when Kendrick dropped the first diss track, which was Control, where he jumped on the track with Big Sean. And he basically called out every rapper that's ever stepped to a mic before and basically challenged them to challenge him. And this is before To Pimp a Butterfly, before Good Kid, Mad City even really takes form and like becomes this cultural zeitgeist kind of a moment.
Yeah.
And so since then, him, Drake, Cole have been taking subtle shots, just saying
they call themselves
the
Big Three.
Yeah, yep. They call themselves, there's an infamous meme out there of them three calling them the heart, the soul, the mind of hip hop. Very funny.
Yes.
And so they've been kind of subtly taking shots back and forth ever since, just saying they're the best and whoever wants to step up, step up. So then we get to this year where Future and Metro Boomin, Metro Boomin's a known op of Drake, but Future is like, plays nice with everybody. They put together an album called We Don't Trust You, and they put together Like That, which is where Kendrick takes this massive shot. And honestly, I did not think J. Cole or Drake would say anything. And I think J. Cole might have stepped in it and then reversed back out of it because this is not in his nature. This is not who we know J. Cole to be. He's the nice guy that's just thankful to be here and this is his life. But I think this proves that like that big three thing is dead. There isn't a big three. There's always ever just been a big two.
I often call myself the J. Cole of podcasting for that very reason, actually. But that's a whole other conversation. Rad, J. Cole's decision to apologize is a thing that has sparked a lot of debate about this because people have been a little bit frustrated, a little bit polarized on that. Where have you seen people landing on the idea of J. Cole putting out a diss track against Kendrick and then a couple days later being like, I'm sorry, I don't think I should have done that?
Yeah. I think there's the people who are heartened by this, you know, because, you know, hip hop tends to be this very toxic masculine space. You know, it feeds off a lot of bravura energy, a lot of puffing of the chest. And so to have a rapper come out and apologize, to be humble, to be like telling everyone that he'd feel much better about himself if he just made peace like that. Like people are finding that, you know, people are finding that heartening in this game. And then there's the people like, man, why are you sucking the fun out of this? Right? Like what?
Because
like,
we want theater, right? Nico, like to Rad's point, like there are some people who are demanding theater in this moment, sort of saying, hey, we know rap beefs are not real. We know that you're not going to like fight in the street. We want you to spar. But to J. Cole's point, Nico, if you put out something and go like, I don't feel like my heart is in it. I feel a little bit bad about the content that I put out. Shouldn't you just be allowed to go, let me walk this one back? I think more people should do that.
I mean, you could walk back the weird transphobia, you know, that is just sort of like
there's
exists
a transphobic line
there
in that,
that
song.
Is just like. Yep. Has sort of like skirted under the radar of the like dialing it back thing. But I kind of agree that like, look, if you're going to do this, do it. And just like, let it, you put it out there. It's out there. Like you can't put the lion back in the cage. So it's out. Like I also want a side project here. I want to pitch that Pablo just has a show where I just want to hear the explanation of rap beefs. Just like, I mean, like I was just like, I was on for the ride. Like this could be a half hour. I'm in. But it's just like, it is this, like, it is part of this. It is part of the world. It is part of this. It is part of the theater of all of this. Yeah. And like to sort of pull back the curtain and make it look like a business decision, just sort of really kind of just, it takes all the wind out of those sails. I'm like, well, what are we actually really doing here? And what is this for? And who is this serving? And like, you know, there should be an element of this sort of like a chaotic energy necessarily, but like it's part of it. It adds to the edge.
I do, you know, I say normalized artists being like, that wasn't my best work. Like normal, like Bradley Cooper come out tomorrow and be like, I don't know about Maestro, guys. That wasn't, should I have made that one? I'm not sure if I should have made that one. Pablo, we've yet to see Drake release a response to Kendrick, which is interesting because like Drake has a history of being pretty responsive, you know, when he gets called out in the past. Like when he had that beef with Mac Mill, he had two diss tracks filed 3 business days later. It was like, oh, I've been dissed. I will go to the studio and I will take care of my business. Drake has just been quiet. What do you make of that silence?
Good. Great. Don't say anything, buddy. Say nothing. After what happened with Pusha T and he decided to be quiet and then he got on his interview with Elliot and B-Dot and said, well, he got really, really personal and so I just couldn't respond anymore. Don't ever respond again because what is this? Everything about rap beef is – the line is wherever you decide to make it, for sure, as the two artists engaging in the beef. But don't respond. You've got your, I like to call his fans Aubrey's Angels. They're defending you to the hilt. They're defending you to the hilt online. Just let them handle your business. You're making all this money in the background. Go on your tour. Just do you. Keep saying your little soliloquies on tour and make your money and say nothing. Raise your kid and say nothing. He's all good.
Raise your kid and say nothing. I actually don't think Drake will recover from Pablo's diss personally, but that's just me.
Okay. I've been known to be an Aubrey's Angel every time or two, but for the most time, just say nothing. We're good. You're good over there, buddy.
Okay, we got a bit of time to move on to this next story. I want to talk about it, which is this new adaptation of the novel, The Talent of Mr. Ripley. It centers on Tom Ripley. He's a struggling con artist who's paid by a wealthy American family to bring their spoiled kid, Dickie, back home from his youthful exploits in Italy. That's the setup that we have here. And this is sort of about Ripley's motivations and how they quickly turn into something a little diabolical. Let's hear a bit of the trailer.
May I ask you to describe Thomas Ripley?
Tom is one of those people who takes advantage of people. He's taking advantage of Dickie.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Rad, people are going to remember the 1999 Oscar-nominated film adaptation that starred Matt Damon of The Talent of Mr. Ripley. What we just heard is some of the trailer of the new Netflix show, Ripley. People are going to naturally, I think, compare the two of them. This new TV series is 8 episodes. How does it compare to the Matt Damon movie, do you think?
I mean, look, like, I think it's worthwhile in a very different way and not better, not worse necessarily. Like, the movie was great. Actually, it's funny because the movie, people didn't even consider it great necessarily at the time. It
Movie's
was actually
great.
Kind of great. Yeah, but it's great. You know, great performances and all that stuff. But captures the story of Ripley within 2.5 hours, so to speak. And then this show gets to kind of luxuriate in the crime and the details in a way that Ripley would actually enjoy. And that's kind of why, in some ways, I prefer the show, because like Andrew Scott being the actor
Ripley,
you might know as a hot priest from Fleabag, like he's playing Ripley, he's playing Ripley. I think his take on Ripley is kind of better, because like the big difference between the show and the movie is the movie, like, Matt Damon's Ripley was more reactive, he was committing crimes out of a crime of passion because he was in love with Dickie, whereas this Ripley is more of a sociopath. He's more dead inside, and he only really comes alive when he could be someone else. So that's what I appreciate about this. You could luxuriate in that. But also, this show is just so gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Like, we never get aesthetics like this, like the framing, the lensing, the black and white cinematography. It's so beautiful. And it's a reminder that, like, you know, we're in this era where movie aesthetics have bled into TV aesthetics, they bled into video game aesthetics, games are now being made into shows, and then social media, where now everything kind of just looks hideous. So to have a show that comes out and actually cares about, like, beautiful cinematography, what a show looks like, and kind of indulge in that artistry, was my jam.
I have to say, seeing you call something good is such a delight, because I'm just very used to Rad coming here and be like, I don't know about this, man. And I go, Rad, what do you know about? You know, what are you excited about? Tell me something you're excited about. So for you to call something gorgeous, I'm like, oh, Rad. I wrote it down. I was like, Rad likes something. That's wild.
The Grinch's beating heart just kind of this is exploded.
This is that moment. Yeah. This is exactly that moment.
When you get a good cold hard sociopath. Yes. I love it.
Listen, Nico, both Ripley and Saltburn being a fairly recent movie, they both sort of touch on some of the same themes. These sort of psychological thrillers centered on characters that are queer-coded, sociopathic, cold-blooded killers. And then this has sort of reignited some conversation about, like, these characters and how they maybe play into historic sort of homophobia around queer folks that we see sort of in cinema. How are you thinking about this? How are you thinking about how these characters are depicted and how it plays into that history?
Well, Ripley in particular, we have to remember, written by a queer woman, written by Patricia Highsmith, written in the mid-50s, is part of there's a series of Ripley novels. Also, Talented Mr. Ripley, the movie that we remember, also not the first and only movie adaptation. There was a couple of different movie adaptations of this series. Yeah, there's a few. That was sort of the big ticket one, but there's been a couple of other attempts at this. And, you know, it is this idea of, like, you can do queer-coded characters that are villains, that are sociopathic or whatever, and if there's no depth, or if there's no understanding, if there's no character to them, sure, that is, we are looking at a harmful trope. But when you take, like, context and character into this portrayal, it it becomes really quite rich, and you start sort of thinking like, okay, so why is he like so invested in this? Why is he so invested in taking over this life? You know, there's a code switching element there. You know, the way that Andrew Scott does this really good job with his body language of like, when he's Tom Ripley, he holds himself differently. When he's like, you know, when he's practicing to be somebody else, he changes his mannerisms. He experiences the world a different way. And there's, you know, there's lots of angles in on this, and it becomes a bit of a richer world for it. And I understand you want to, like, a lot of people will be reactive to this discourse on it and say like, well, this is problematic. But I do think it's like, it's deeper and richer than that. And it warrants a further conversation of like, what was the time this was written in that it's set in, and what is this saying about the world that Tom Ripley exists in?
Pablo, I got about a minute left here. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think when you think about depth in characters and how characters are developed, I think especially when you're writing about queer characters, it's important to give them a backstory other than just being queer. Like, why are they doing these things? What is the motivation? As Nico said, like, who is this person and why are they this way? And it's not just directed because they're queer. It's because of other things, their life experiences, different things color these people other than just being a queer person. Mm-hmm. So I am enjoying the series as someone who just recently watched the film for the first time as well. Yeah. So it's like a whole nother depth to this character. And I'm having a great time. I'm excited to continue watching it.
I think part of what makes this series work really well is also just Andrew Scott. I think, Rad, you mentioned Andrew Scott earlier. Andrew Scott is like such a rich tapestry to sort of project characters onto, because he's just so good at embodying all these different kinds of characters. Also, I'm out of time, so we got to leave it there. So Pablo, Nico, Rad, thank you for your time, for your generosity and your thoughts. I really appreciate it, you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nico Stratus is a culture critic who writes the newsletter Anxiety Shark from Toronto. Rad Simon Pillay is a freelance film critic whose work shows up in the Globe and Mail, on CTV, and right here on Commotion. And Pablo the Don is a culture critic and part of Those Wrestling Girls podcast. They were in Springfield, Massachusetts. You can catch Ripley on Netflix. By the way, Fallout actor Kyle MacLachlan just spoke with our pal Tom Power. You should absolutely go and find Q's podcast to hear that interview. And that is it for the podcast today. Before I go, I want to tell you about the incredible folks that helped get the show on the air. Commotion was produced this week by Stuart Berman, Ty Callender, Gene Kim, Jane Vancouverden, and Jess Lowe. Our digital producers are Amelia Ekbal and Chuli Grossman-Gray. Danielle Grogan is our director. Our engineer is Gabby Hagarillis. Our senior producer is John Perry. Anne McKeegan is the executive producer of the show. My name is Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud. I will see you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.